It's Radio Free 501c, the podcast of Rogue Tulips Consulting. I'm your host, Cecilia Sopp, and we're so excited to be back for Season 6 and continue bringing you outstanding ideas and thought leaders and different ways of thinking. So don't forget to subscribe because you're not going to want to miss any of it. This week, I'm welcoming back my longtime friend and colleague, Jeff DeCagna. He's a fellow at ASAE, and he is on a tour to remind us to think about the duty of foresight and how it affects designing the future. It's March 11th, 2024. Welcome to episode 232. Hey, everybody, it's Monday, March 11th, and that means it's time for another episode of Radio Free 501c, brought to you by Rogue Tulips Consulting. I'm your host, Cecilia Sepp. I'm the principal and founder of Rogue Tulips. And to our entire global audience, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you may be. And thank you for joining us this week. I'm really excited to welcome back Jeff DeCagna, a longtime friend and colleague of mine. And I know you all think of him as a contrarian, but I just think of him as my old friend, Jeff, who I like to talk to. So we're here today. He is on a tour to promote the duty of foresight. And this is a really important perspective that boards should adopt and be familiar with. And Jeff's an expert on this topic. He's here to help us understand it and how we can help our boards. But before we dive into that topic, Jeff, welcome back. Would you like to say hello and tell the audience a little about yourself?
Well, thanks, Cecilia. It's a pleasure to be back. And yes, I was thinking about, as I was getting ready for this conversation, that we've known each other for 30 years. Going back to when we were working at what was then the American Corporate Counsel Association. They've changed their name since then. And so that was quite a fun time for me working there with you and being a part of that organization. I've been in the association community. You can gather from that information. I've been in the association community for a while, 32 years now, and the last it's actually now my 33rd year. So the last 23 of those, this is now the 23rd year of consulting, working with associations first on the work of innovation under the banner of principled innovation. And then in 2017, really building on what I'd been doing before, but taking it in a different direction, changing the name to Foresight First in 2017 to really focus on trying to help boards set a higher standard of stewardship, governing, and foresight, my methodology for building board capacity. And as part of that, I coined the term the duty of foresight in 2014. And that really became the impetus for moving things forward. I've been working on that for the last 10 years. And as you mentioned, kind of marking a milestone for the duty of foresight in 2024.
I'm glad you brought up that I brought up that we used to work together and you mentioned we did have a lot of fun. And that's why I kind of joke around sometimes. I knew Jeff DeCagna before he was Jeff DeCagna. Because one of the things I often think about when I think about our time working together at what is now the Association of Corporate Counsel is you already were thinking this way. You already had that spark. Like you would come in to our staff meetings when we're getting ready for our annual conference and say, here's our word for the meeting. Whatever that word might be, whether it's excellence or service, whatever that word was. And I always was really impressed by that. And to anybody who worked with us at that time who made fun of Jeff, shame on you, because he was right. So, and that was one of my favorite things about getting to know you is you were always very thoughtful and looking ahead like that. And I do want to say Jeff's office used to be right next door to mine, and he was a great office neighbor. So that's a little fun history about that. And also, you know, how organizations evolve since it's gone from ACCA to ACC. So let's bring it back to the duty of foresight. Because again, Jeff, you've been thinking this way for years. I often think about your watershed article, Destroying Mediocrity, which I think was one of the early steps to get you to this point. So before we start talking about the duty of foresight, could you explain for the audience what foresight is?
Sure. So you really took me down memory lane there with Destroying Mediocrity, because that was something I wrote in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I got in trouble for that article.
I remember that.
at my employer, you know, at the time was not happy about what I had written, even though, and you know, it was a tough time, but that was 20 plus years ago. So foresight, you know, is something that is getting a lot of conversation in our community, has been for a while, and I'm glad about that because it's really important. And certainly, ASAE has made a big investment and big effort to build the Foresight Works research initiative, which has been a great, I think, benefit to our community to have those resources available. But foresight itself, there are many definitions of foresight that people use. There are some that have, you know, more that are more technical in nature, have more words in them than the one that I'm going to share with you. But for a long time, I have felt that the best way to define foresight is an intentional process of learning with the future. That basically, you know, what we are trying to do in the work of foresight is get a better picture of what the world could look like in some plausible time horizon that is still in front of us. And generally speaking, you know, when I'm thinking about this in the context of boards, if you take a 120-month period in total, right, a decade-long period, and break it down, the way that I like to break it down is there's 36 months of strategy window in which the organization can really say, okay, here's how we're going to create value for and with our stakeholders. And in today's environment, you have to break those 36 months down a little bit more. It's more like, what do we do in the first 12? What do we do in the next 12, or, you know, 12 to 18, that kind of thing. There's so much, it's so dynamic in the environment that we need shorter windows for how our strategy is going to adapt to what's happening, you know, as our organizations try to navigate the environment. And then there's the 84 months beyond that. So 36 months of strategy window, 84 months of foresight horizon. Which is really where I like to situate the attention of boards and to be able to say, okay, this is where we need you to focus your work in understanding how these 84 months beyond strategy could plausibly unfold by simply asking the question, what could the world look like in 2028 or 2029 or 2030? Give them a defined horizon for that and begin to investigate, explore based on information we already have, data we already have. Perspectives, you know, imagination can be really powerful in all of this. There's a huge aspect of foresight that's about what we can imagine. But we have to be able to imagine not just the things that we want to have happen, not just the sort of favorable or preferred futures. We also have to be able to look at the unfavorable futures and even the unthinkable futures, the literal worst case scenarios. And looking at that, investigating them, understanding them, questioning them, so we can get a better picture of what they could look like, and then bringing that back into the current time horizon and asking a different question, which is, what do we need to do to steer ourselves away from those futures that we don't want and toward the futures that we would like to see happen in our organizations? And that's a very straightforward, you know, way of looking at it. And that's why I think about it in a learning process, because we're learning with the future by examining it even before it happens. And then we're learning with it again by watching it unfold, looking for certain indicators that we might be going in a direction that we maybe didn't expect or in a direction that we did envision, we did anticipate. And so through foresight, we build anticipatory capacity, we build adaptive capacity for organizations, we strengthen our learning capacity as an organization. And it's a very inclusive process because since it is a learning-oriented process, we absolutely want to include the perspectives of a wide variety of contributors in the work. And so therefore, you know, we want to go as the board may be the primary champions of this, as we'll discuss, but we need to have a lots of other voices in the process to ensure the board's getting a lots of different perspectives into what it looks like. So that's the way that I think about foresight and the way I talk about it with boards.
Well, that's a great explanation. Thank you. Very interesting. Because, you know, being from Missouri, I'm more of a plain speaker, and I'm just kind of like, well, you got to look ahead and see what might happen. Because, you know, but that's a great way. And also the consensus, not so much consensus building, but getting the different perspectives from as many people as possible is very important. And I think it goes a little bit beyond environmental scanning and situational awareness, although those are both key to a successful process. Now that we know what foresight is from your perspective and how you work it with boards, you have said that it's a choice to practice the duty of foresight, but it's also necessary. It's a need. So how can you get a board or convince a board, I guess, to make that choice and understand the necessity of it?
So Let's break that down a little bit, you know, and sort of unpack it a little bit. So it's definitely a choice, right? Because, as you know, there are the three duties that every board is mandated to follow, right? The duties of care, loyalty, and obedience. So those duties exist for boards. They are compelled to follow them by statute, by case law, by regulation. And every board should follow them, and every board must follow them, and so that's that's where that's at, and that's fine, right? Having been a director, having been a board officer, and having spent a lot of years, as I said, working with boards and explaining to boards from a layman's perspective. I'm not an attorney, but I feel like after all these years, I've got a pretty good handle on how to talk about these three duties. I explain them a lot and talk about them a lot. They're very important from the very beginning. It was clear to me the duty of foresight, which has a slightly different definition today than it did when I first started, which I can certainly refer to shortly. But I always felt that it was a choice. Like in the very beginning, when I first wrote about it in 2014, I thought, okay, maybe there's something that we want to do to try to make this essentially the fourth duty. And I explored it briefly, but then I started to think about it, and I'm glad I went this way, that it really should be a choice. That boards, boards should be able to have the agency to decide that they want to do this versus simply having yet another duty that compels them. So I would like to see boards be impelled by the importance of the duty of foresight to make this choice and to move it forward. When I say that it's necessary, or when I think that it's needed, I think that, when I really, the way I tend to think about it is, I mean, there's so many reasons why it's needed. I think that the duty of foresight is needed because, we need, our boards need to be better at risk, evaluation, risk appreciation, as certainly even before you get to risk management, that they need to have better discernment around what the risks are, what the principal threats are. I think the duty of foresight can help with that. I think that it's an important, as I've said, an important learning capacity building for boards to be able to do that is going to enrich their experience and also strengthen their organizations. I think it's necessary to encourage that level of responsibility. But the another way of looking at it that I'm starting to talk more about, and I think I've talked about it a little bit in the past, but I want to bring it more front and center, in 2024 as I go through this process of talking about the duty of foresight on the occasion of this 10-year milestone, is that, a board and association really exists in three ways. There's the board is contained in the bylaws, right? So we have a governing document that outlines what the board is and who's on it and what their role is, that kind of thing. Then there's the board that consists of the people who serve on it today, right? The current board, the current people, the current human population of the board, if you will. And then there's the board as a construct of continuity in our organizations, right? For as long as our organizations have existed, there was a board back in the day, and there was a board more recently, and there's a board today, and there'll be a board in the future. Ideally, that's the way we sort of think about it. In each one of those contexts, the board needs the duty of foresight. That legal structure needs that way of thinking about, okay, we've got to anticipate where we're going. As I mentioned earlier, we've got to have a better sense of what we might face, right? The board of today needs this construct, needs this way of thinking to galvanize, to kind of pull together its agency. Well, there's that word again, but I think it's so important to galvanize its agency to be able to act on behalf of, its stakeholders, but even more importantly, successors, right? That's central to the definition that I use for the duty of foresight now, right? The duty of foresight requires association boards to stand up for their successors' futures through intentional learning, through short-term sacrifice, and taking a long-term view. And so the board today needs that as a way to think about its own work. And then the board as a construct of continuity, as a part of the organization that existed before today, it exists today and will exist in the future. We're setting an example, right? We're setting a tone for the board of the future that when you choose this and when you go down this pathway, you are creating the conditions for the organization to be stronger, and we want to set that example for every board that follows the one that is currently seated. Because every time the board changes, some people leave, new people come on, the composition is changing. So we want to continue to set that example of why this is so important for the long term, so that successor boards over time will continue to make the same choice, right? So if you look at it in all three dimensions of how boards exist, then I think that the needs there are many and significant, and provide real opportunities for us to think differently about what boards do, which is really what this is all about. Think about what they do, how it's different or needs to be different in the 2020s and beyond, how it can be different, how it can be more purposeful, and how it can be more focused on the future and on benefiting those who will never be known to us. We can leave our organizations better than how we found them for those who will follow us. And that's a good thing. And I think we need more of that in our organizations as we look toward the rest of this decade and beyond.
I agree with you, and I think that's a good way to look at it. I recently wrote a blog post called Dr. Manhattan, The Passage of Time in Associations, in which I basically discuss the same thing, the organization's life, past, present, future, all in existence at the same time, even though maybe not in the same space. That's getting a little deep and off track from what talking about the
Oh,
boards
it's good.
adopting the duty of foresight. I also think I disagree with you a little bit, though, about the duty of foresight not being a requirement. I think that as a leader, and the board of directors is the leadership group of the organization setting that path to the future for those who come after them, I think it's almost an implicit requirement of leadership, because if you look at the very early days of humans coming together for survival, the leader's job was to keep the group alive, and survival was success. So you always had to be looking around. Are we in a place where we have enough food and water, or do we have to move? Are there enemies around us, etc.? So to me, leadership, the duty of foresight, even though you have brought it out and made it explicit, to me, and again, my opinion, has always been an implicit responsibility of leadership to think about that potential future and how are we going to get there and what happens if something gets in our way. So I agree with you on the duty of foresight, but and they do need to choose it, but I think maybe they should think of it more as a requirement or more of a serious responsibility.
Yeah, no, I mean I certainly, would agree. I actually don't see it as something where we disagree. What I would say is I just want to leave it to them to make this explicit choice, for themselves, rather than, rather than mandating it, sort of forcing it upon them as just another thing they have to, worry about as part of a checklist of items that might come up during an
True.
onboarding session or something like that,
Right.
right? So, because really, by giving them, by creating the conditions, under which they will choose it, it gives them the ability, to really shape it in a way that's they can see as to be most beneficial. I think that is often the problem that I encounter or have encountered throughout the years that I've been working with boards, is that and my own experience serving on boards as well, is that so much of this is do all these things that we tell you you have to do, and we don't necessarily help them to be as effective in trying to make the choices of things that they could do that could really have, high level benefits, and high level benefits, not just for the association or for the profession or industry it's serving, not just high level benefits for the stakeholders that they're serving, not just high level benefits for successors, but high level benefits for them as well, because we don't want to ignore the fact that people come to boards for different reasons. I would like very much for boards to see themselves as stewards and that that's the reason why they're there, leaving it better than how they found it, and that kind of thing. But I also recognize that people come there with other reasons that they want to be on a board because they'd like to, build their resume, or maybe they're using it as a way to get to another board or something like that. And I'm not, I wouldn't want that to be the primary motivation. It's too self-interested to sort of see it that way. But I'm not discounting the fact that that exists. And so what I would say, and I think it's consistent with your point, which is that if you want to be someone who is an effective director, so that you can talk about being an effective director that gets you your next opportunity, or maybe it helps you get your next job or whatever, then you should look at this in a very serious way, because it's this way of thinking and it's this way of acting and it's this way of interacting with your board colleagues that's going to make you more interesting as a candidate for other possibilities. So if you're looking, people are looking for the self-interested hook in the idea of the duty of foresight, then I would say that's it. I would say this is your opportunity to differentiate yourself from many, many other people who serve on boards who won't necessarily, make this choice. And by demonstrating that you're part of the choice, you are starting from a good place of saying, okay, I get it, and now I want to be a part of it. And that's also going to be a part of what makes people appealing to others as they continue their careers and their board journeys over time. So yeah, I would love for every board to choose it. And I do think that there's an inherent responsibility that goes along with it. I just want to help people sort of see that they can make a decision in all of this, that it's not all thrust upon them and predetermined what their board experience is going to look like. We do have some ability, flexibility to design it in ways that will make it more beneficial for everyone involved, including those who serve.
That's right. Well, and I think that practicing the duty of foresight to make to your point about it can help you in your career, it can help you get onto a different board and advance yourself personally and professionally. And the duty of foresight actually is going to help people work on their critical thinking skills and their
Absolutely.
analytical skills. And it's also going to develop that strategic outlook that leaders need to have in order to practice foresight. You have to think strategically, not tactically. And I think we all have had those experiences with boards who are tactical, not strategic, and they're not doing what they should be doing. And I don't think they're always getting what they need consistently. Another topic for another day. But this is great. So I want to talk with you a little bit. Something that you mentioned, the orthodox beliefs that organizations hold on to and some professions hold on to. And I think that's well in line with what you were saying about the past, present, and future boards are all in tandem in existence at the same time. So, what's your definition of an orthodox belief, and then what do you think its impact is on people being able to choose the duty of foresight?
Yeah. So I know that sometimes when I've talked about this, people are like, what does this have to do with foresight? Like, why do you start a conversation about the future by talking about the past? And I think inherent in the idea of foresight, just in foresight methodology, is that you do want to look backwards even as you're looking forwards. And part of the way that I want to encourage boards to look backward is to try to help them understand how orthodox beliefs, which I define as the deep-seated assumptions we make about how the world works, beliefs that have been inculcated into our organizations over many years and decades, inculcated into us, right? We talked earlier about, our friendship going back 30 years, and we worked in an organization 30 years ago that had its own orthodox beliefs, some of which I'm sure we still hold on to all these 30 years later about how things get done and that sort of thing. And we've each had other work experiences since then. Each stop along the way, each professional stop, each personal interaction creates a new set of orthodoxies that we operate under. And it's perfectly natural. It's a human way of dealing with, issues that are out there because we simply don't have the cognitive bandwidth to be able to make decisions about every single thing every day anew, right? Without some shortcuts to be able to deal with things. The question is when orthodoxy becomes a problem, which it almost always does in, when we're talking about board decision making, right? And so what we have to do is separate out what's the orthodoxy, right? What are the assumptions that are invisible and detrimental from what are the principles and justified beliefs that we can use, that we can continue to use as a basis for our decision making, right? So that's a part of the process. But really, the bigger issue is that the more we're committed to orthodoxy, the harder it is for us to learn about the future. The more that we're thinking about a world that no longer exists, if it ever actually existed in the way that we think it did, which is part of what orthodoxy does, right? It gives us these sort of romantic sometimes, or at least clouded view of what the past looked like. It's very hard to open oneself up to the kind of learning that's required because we define ourselves significantly by our belief system, right? And that's what the orthodox beliefs that we've picked up along the way, that we've built for ourselves along the way, how they really shape, our thinking. So this is always the hardest conversation that I have with every board. It's almost always the first conversation that I have with the board. We got to start with the orthodoxy because there's very, let's just say, the chances, the odds of being successful in a future-oriented way of thinking about things are greatly reduced if you are stuck in a belief system of the past. And so I will sometimes refer to orthodoxy as the noise of the past, and we have to turn down the volume on the noise of the past. I'm under no illusion that we'll be able to get rid of everyone's orthodox beliefs in total. They're going to be there. We just have to turn down their noise and reduce their influence so that we can then turn up the signal of what we have to hear all around us. And right now, it feels like so many of the signals are blaring at us, so we don't have to struggle to hear them. But if we can't square our belief system, with something that is leaning toward the future, it's going to be very hard to do the really kind of intentional learning that's required for an organization to, for a board and the association to move forward under the conditions that we're facing in 2024, and we'll certainly continue to face as we move through the rest of this decade. So orthodoxy is an impediment. It's a barrier. And we've got to remove it as best we can, or at least lower it, so that we can really undertake this more challenging work of learning what the future and reorienting our conversations and decision making toward that outcome.
Yes, that is an excellent point, because I think if we could get people to realize, well, your orthodox belief was once a new idea that people probably push back against. All orthodoxy start out as new. And actually, one of my favorite examples was actually when we were working at ACCA and we were doing a networking event at a conference, and we changed the way we were doing the networking event. And one of the members came up to me and said, "I'm very nervous about this." And I said, "Why? It's a networking event." And he said, "Well, what if it doesn't work?" And I said, "Then we won't do it again." "Oh, we won't do it again."
I remember actually when we had an event. I remember which meeting it was, but we had an event, and my boss, who was one of the big executives there, Susan Hackett. She one of her things was, let's do a thing. We was like a sort of had like a collegiate kind of theme. So let's do a thing where everyone had a thing that they wore that showed where they went to law school, right? And so they just had a little badge that gave the name of their law school. So this way they could find people at the event, based upon where they had gone to school. And I can remember that a lot of people were not 100% sure whether that was a good idea. And it's such a small example, but it challenged the orthodoxy of that kind of thing. How do you build relationships between people? That's a small thing. It was a small step. I think it worked great. And it could start a whole lot of new conversations, for people. So I just think that there's so much more we can do if we can, steer ourselves away from the orthodoxy, turn that volume down so we can think more about where we're headed.
Well, that and I think in nonprofit management, we spend a lot of time talking about what we're going to do and don't actually do it. So when somebody comes along and says, "Yeah, just do it, just flip the button and turn it on," people are shocked, as, "Well, just do it." Okay, we've analyzed, we've got to take an action now. And I think
Absolutely.
that that's really just those just really funny, strange examples we just shared. It's like they're so
Yeah.
small, yet cause so much controversy.
It's true.
It's just really orthodoxy is okay if it's still applicable. So, and you can always go backwards if you don't want to go
Yeah,
forward.
and yeah, and the one thing I just want to add to that is because I think it's important since we're talking about boards here, when I have this conversation with boards, I always say to them, look, you're not to blame for the existence of orthodoxy, right? It predates you, right? It's been around for a long time. You may be sharing it, but that's not your fault because it was here, right? And so you were, it takes what, 10 or 15 or more years for someone to get to the board. So you've been inculcated into the same orthodoxy for the entire time since you joined, right? It's okay. But now that you're here, now that you're on the board, and now that you have an awareness of its existence, you do have a responsibility to figure out how to address it, right? You can't continue to allow the orthodoxy to shape the way you have conversations. Because if you just say, well, the orthodoxy is there and I can't do anything about it, so let's just move on, then you're going to continue to build your future organization on the basis of a set of beliefs that maybe were never actually true to begin with. And certainly need to be at least examined and I think actually confronted. Because when I first started talking about orthodoxy 15 or more years ago, I thought, okay, this is an interesting sort of side conversation that could have value, but it's never going to be central. And now I kind of think of it as one of the principal threats that we face through the rest of this decade and going into the 2030s. is how do we overcome this belief system? We got a small glimpse of what it could look like during the lockdown, right, a few years ago, when organizations had no choice but to confront their orthodoxy. There were no alternatives, right? You've got to do it this way because we're in the middle of a global health emergency.
That's right.
And we've now turned backwards, right? Now that things are a little more familiar, a little more comfortable, I can't say that they're normal because nothing that's really going on now is normal based upon what's happened these last, few years. But we're definitely in a more, in a different place. So people feel a little more comfortable going back to where they were, or really want to get back to a place where they feel like they're more in control. And that has led to a level of complacency that I find quite scary. And at the heart of that complacency is the orthodoxy. And that's what we've got to continue to challenge, and get back to the place that we were a couple of years ago, but without the fear and suffering of a
Right.
global health emergency,
That's the
right?
trauma.
But with a choice. Like, again, once again, it's a choice to say, let's not continue to perpetuate a belief system that is clearly unhelpful to us, and instead build a new way of thinking, a new belief system that is better suited to where we're going.
That's right. And you know that I agree with you. I see too many things slipping backwards again. People being resistant to remote work or hybrid work again, not realizing the benefits of that. But I also have come to realize people are like water and they will always take the same path. It's very difficult to move water. That's why you have to build a dam or you have to build a canal. You have to do something to very forcibly move the water in a different direction. And I think that is a really good allegory for trying to get people to change the way they think and understanding that they can do things differently. You're in a different world now. You have that choice, you have that power to be different. And it's very much like lately I've been thinking a lot about how things are going in our profession as nonprofit management professionals. And you know, a lot of people saying, well, you know, kind of falling back into that, oh, this way we've always done it, or that's just the way it is. And this like, you know, passive acceptance of things that could be changed. And I, you know, I often think of the story of the Wizard of Oz. You know, Dorothy could have gone home the whole time. She had the power to go home the entire time. She just didn't realize she had that power to do it. And I think that's really a lot of what we see with boards not realizing they do have that power to make a different choice, and they have the power. And when I say power, I don't mean power like controlling other people, but you know, you have the energy, the power, the resources to make things happen differently. And I think that's a good segue into another point you like to make, which is talking about how do you get the boards to actually adopt and start practicing the duty of foresight? Like how can they put it into their workflow, their thought process?
So yeah, and I love what you were just saying because it feeds right into this, right? Is, this is what I mean when I talk about agency, right? Each of us has individual agency, boards have a collective agency to make choices and to make those choices, to work to make those choices happen, right? And I sometimes think that that agency actually gets surrendered to orthodoxy. Like, we can't do this because our orthodox beliefs basically prevent us from taking these steps, right? So we have, that's another reason why this is so important. To your question, so much of the work that I am doing around this is predicated upon the idea of next practices, right? So I don't like to wade into the whole, what's a best practice kind of thing, because who gets to decide that, and that, and that's kind of, there's a lot of nonsense embedded in that conversation. Instead, what I like to help organizations do, and really, I think of the duty of foresight itself as a next practice, and so many of the practices that I've built around it, and just the whole idea that we can design next practices, right? So this is a very design oriented approach, a learning oriented approach, and next practices are, ideas and approaches and concepts that are intended to challenge the orthodoxy, right? That's their purpose, and to help our boards, begin to develop the kinds of core convictions and habits of mind that are required for basically for board service in this decade and the decades ahead, right? Like, we have to have more resilient, anticipatory, and capable boards, and more responsible boards, and we need different kinds of convictions from them in terms of their what they're going to do on in this role, and also how they're going to think about their service in this role. So it's really coming down to the next practices piece. And when an organization, when a board, an association chooses the duty of foresight, the implications of that choice are, we're going to change a lot around how the board does its work, because what we really need to do is focus board attention on these conversations and remove many of the things that boards have historically done, the traditional activities, and move them somewhere else, right? Or find other ways to get them addressed. So if we have to have a Zoom meeting, for example, before an in-person meeting, let's do the business that would customarily fill that agenda in a Zoom meeting so that we can get it out of the way. Or if we don't want to do that, let's figure out how a committee or something could do it, or let's figure out how staff could do it. Let's figure out an alternative way, because really a lot of the things we put on board agendas don't actually require the board to be involved. And so developing next practices that can reframe the work that gets done, create better use of the time and attention that's available during meetings, change the way boards and committees and staff work together in terms of what board-ready information looks like, how they collaborate, another way of developing next practices, developing decision-making or guiding principles of action, decision-making principles that boards can use, articulating governing intent, right, which is an expression of the board's outcomes that it wants to work on through stewardship. And that's often the place where boards will make a commitment, sort of verbalize or, codify their commitment to the duty of foresight. So it's using a series of next practices that can be built together, right, fit together basically to enable the board to do this work and to encourage others to participate in this work, to invite them into the process. Earlier you mentioned environmental scanning, which can be a useful input to this process. That's a useful practice to adopt, developing futures, developing scenarios of what the world could look like, another foresight methodology that can be a useful practice. So it's fitting together the next practices of actual board functioning, board work and collaboration with staff partners and other contributors, while also introducing the foresight methodologies into some of the work, and just really reconfiguring in many ways what the board has historically done. So we stop, consuming board time on, reviewing 990s or other kinds of, pro forma document things. Not to say that any of that's unimportant, or it's important. It is very important, but we have to find other ways to do it so we can get concentrated opportunities for boards to work, because ultimately what this comes down to is how do we best use board attention? Time is very precious, but attention is even more precious. So how do we best use board attention for this very important work? And I think we can do that. I know we can do that when we start using a combination of next practices to get the duty of foresight to be the central way that they're looking at things, and reorganize the work to give them the opportunity to really dive into these very important conversations and decisions that they'll make that will shape. They will be shaping futures that don't belong to them. I think that's important to note, right? That's why this is such a critical issue. They're shaping futures that belong to other people. And so the more that they take that responsibility seriously by designing ways of acting upon it, then I think the stronger their work will be, and ultimately the stronger the association will become over time.
Yeah, and that's, and I think that as we're wrapping up this conversation, a specific example is in order. We've all been talking a lot about artificial intelligence. You've been talking about a lot. I've been blogging about it. Other people are jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak. I'm not so much a cynic and a Luddite about it, but I am not an early adopter. I have a much more cautious viewpoint of it for a lot of reasons. But I know that you've been talking to a lot of people, you've been writing about it, presenting about it. So how is artificial intelligence an example of where the duty of foresight could be a wonderful tool for a board looking forward?
Yeah, and I've got, as you know, I've written and spoken about the concerns I have about, how we're approaching approaching artificial intelligence in our community. And I think what I've noticed recently is how much of the trust factors that go into our thinking about technology are being damaged on a global basis by the way we see the artificial intelligence conversation unfolding at that level. And it's certainly having an effect, or will continue to have an effect on our organizations. I think the way that the duty of foresight, there's so many ways that we could talk about it, but one very specific way that I think is crucial here is that right now, I think the way we've centered, just based on everything I've seen and heard and read and observed in conversations I've had, we're centering the artificial intelligence conversation in the present day of the use case On a very consumer, oriented basis, right? We see our staff as workers who consume products, and if we can get this product in their hands, we can make them more productive and that sort of thing. And I get it. I understand why that's an issue. I think actually for boards though, and maybe that's what CEOs and C-suite executives and other on the ground staff decision makers need to focus on right now. And I don't necessarily preclude that from being a part of the conversation. That's not my intention. But from a board perspective, specifically from a board perspective, and really from a board and CEO collaboration perspective, I think what's central is that they start situating the discussion around artificial intelligence in the successor timeframe, in the 72, 84, 96, 120 month, sort of timeframe, to say, what can we do? How can we think about artificial intelligence in a way that will serve those people better than just what we think we can do right now to be more productive and efficient? I think a more successor-centric way of looking at artificial intelligence using the duty of foresight would be an incredibly positive step for boards to take in this environment to really recenter their decision making and rethink, reframe their perspective around what their responsibilities are to those who will follow them, because that's whose future is being shaped. As I said, around artificial intelligence right now, not even so much what's happening in our organizations today, but what will happen to our successors as we go into the 2030s. So I think that's a step that every board should be considering right now.
So when I'm just trying to think, how can I phrase this next question? So we're looking for, we're building the future. And maybe, maybe this is a good time to ask you, what is your closing thought? What would you like the audience to take away today from all this? The duty of foresight and choosing it, and then how it impacts things like the incorporation of artificial intelligence into work and in content creation and management. What does this all mean in a world where the ground's constantly shifting, and more than it ever has in any other century in recorded history? The ground's shifting under us, minute by minute.
It is a time of great instability, and that's not going to go away. And so I think the way you frame it is a good way, because when the context is so, there is such a high level of instability, a high level of brittleness, a high level of anxiety, more nonlinearity, more incomprehensibility. That's a framework that a futurist, Jamai Cascio, has used. The acronym is BANI: brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible. When those are the conditions in which you're operating, you need to have something to hold on to that is really important to you. Like, you can't rely necessarily that the conditions themselves are going to resolve in your favor and that you'll find that solid ground on things. So what is it you hold on to? And for me, the thing that I hold on to is a question that I ask myself every day, every time I do a podcast interview like this one, write an article or whatever. And the same question keeps coming up: what will our successors say about us? And I think every board and every one of us, every decision maker, certainly, and everyone serving in any kind of capacity in a governance role should be asking themselves that question: what will our successors say about us? And the reason for that is because rather than a legacy conversation, which is so much about us shaping stories that we want other people to tell about us, in which we feature as the heroes in those narratives, is really to think about what is it we're going to do? What actions are we going to take starting today in 2024 that will leave it better for them than how we found it, right? And the more that we, so it's going to, we will be evaluated by our long-term successors based on our choices and actions of today, and building those choices over time with our successor boards, right? They will determine what we have done and how well we've done it on their behalf. I think that's what we have to hold on to in these times, understanding that there's a longer term picture here for which we're responsible, at least in part right now. So what will our successors say about us? Anyone looking for inspiration, for motivation, for anything that's going to help them move the conversation in a beneficial way? I think that question, more than anything else, is a place to start. It's not the totality of everything, but it's a good starting point because it forces you to reframe your perspective on why you're doing things. Are you doing things only for the short-term gain, or are you doing something with a long-term view in mind, knowing that you are part of a continuum of predecessors and successors who have always relied upon each other historically throughout the entire history of the association world, going back to the time Alexis de Tocqueville walked around the country and started writing about this and democracy in America, right? So let's think about how we can be a part of that, tradition, if you want to think about tradition, the tradition of thinking about those who will follow us. What will our successors say about us is a hugely powerful question for boards and all decision makers to ask, that I think provides you with some compass, if you will, to navigate a very unstable and challenging environment.
I think that is a great closing thought. And
Thanks.
especially that question, what will our successors think of us? What have we done to, I get, I love to use sports analogies, move the ball down the field, because that's really what we're trying to do here into the future. So, Jeff, always great talking with you. Always love
You
having you
too.
on the podcast. How can
Thanks.
people get in touch with you if they'd like to follow up and learn more about your thoughts on the duty of foresight, or how maybe they could talk with you about it?
Yeah. So two best ways, Jeff at foresightfirst.io is my email address. It's .io, not .com. So Jeff at foresightfirst.io. And then you can find me on LinkedIn, and I have my own, I guess you'd call it a vanity URL, but I'm not vain. And it's just simply Jeff on LinkedIn.com.
I love it. Okay, I should do that. That's just my name, but no, it's great. Well, thank you again, Jeff. And unfortunately, we have to go rogue for now, but we'll be back next time with another exciting episode. So please remember to follow or subscribe so you don't miss anything. If you'd like to learn more about Rogue Tulips Consulting and how we can help you bloom outside the box, check out our website, roguetulips.com. We also have an education program that can help you get ready for the CAE exam or get continuing education for your renewal application, and you can access that through the website as well. So, on behalf of Jeff and myself, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.